question. What are the general similarities and differences between the practice of Anapanasati and Satipatthana? Are they the same practice? Thank you. Satipatthana is broader. I mean, these are the foundations of mindfulness, and so that there's a broader, maybe more extensive, in the delineation of, say, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feeling, mindfulness of the mind, mindfulness of dhammas, of mental phenomena. Say, mindfulness of breathing is like a subset of Satipatthana. But it's also the Buddha, in the Anapanasati Sutta, he actually specifically says that the practice of Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, brings to fruition the Satipatthana practice, and so that the way that the Buddha lays out mindfulness of breathing, the last couple of days I've given some reflections on mindfulness of breathing. It's been mostly what I've talked about. It's been mostly about the body, but the different steps in mindfulness of breathing actually go on to use the base or the foundation of the feeling, of the mind, of dhammas, also incorporating it into the mindfulness of breathing practice. They're linked, not the same practice. Mindfulness of the Satipatthana, foundations of mindfulness, are probably a lot more extensive, a bit broader. Oh my gosh, okay. We try to give small pieces of paper. Managed to get a lot onto this one. It's great. Okay. I just wanted to make sure that I didn't want to subject people too much. It's very good. I'm just saying, I was saddened to hear the time for the Q&A may be limited and not all questions may get answered. This Q&A time has been a highlight of this retreat for me for many years and is quite unique, as I have not experienced this extensive a Q&A on other retreats. I felt from the first time I sat this retreat that the Q&A was a way the Sangha could communicate even though we are in silence. Hearing all the questions, which are questions we all share, as none are truly unique to the person who asked, makes me feel so much more strongly the community of Sangha, and the universality of our challenges. Only some of us are able to articulate the words into questions, and your thoughtful, considerate, compassionate, and comprehensive answers have benefited me and so many others on the retreat. I thank you for all the years of your practice in answering all the questions, all in caps. Every question is invaluable and important to the person who wrote it. It is unfortunate. Some are uncomfortable with the length of time it takes to answer all the questions, as you stated. We are a mixed group in age and experience. I so appreciate every single one and every one of your monastics. my question? Question mark. And it's just a little bit. Can we keep all the questions getting answered? So we'll see how it goes. But you know, I'd
now there's going to be less time because of help.
But the that's why I've done it in the past is because I feel that the questions are beneficial, and I think everybody benefits, but we'll see. I just was concerned. Actually, I didn't really get any complaints, but it was my own. a concern that it drags on a bit too much. You can get too much of a good thing sometimes. Okay, can you say something about forgiveness practice? I think one of the things is like with forgiveness, that it's a way. I mean, I think it's like it probably could be an aspect of loving kindness practice. In the sense that by offering forgiveness, then it's an act of kindness to ourselves when we're willing to direct our attention to forgiveness and then being able to maybe drop something, some hurt or some pain that we've experienced, so it's a way of resolving something that might be painful. Forgiveness doesn't necessarily, it doesn't mean, say, condoning. Because there's a difference between, say, like forgiveness and reconciliation. I think it's an important distinction to make, in the sense that, because you can offer forgiveness, and that can come from our side in a way to, say, as an act of kindness to ourselves, so that we don't have to carry something that's been hurtful. But unless there's and forgiveness can be kind of one way. Reconciliation really it needs to be both ways, so that sometimes one can offer forgiveness, but there might not be reconciliation because. It requires participation and acknowledgement, so that but for ourselves, we can go a long way as an act of kindness to ourselves, to be willing to offer forgiveness, because it's that holding on to something that is painful or hurtful that keeps the mind in turmoil. And it doesn't mean that, and again, it doesn't mean that one is condoning something that has been hurtful, but it's sort of like you realize sometimes you just don't understand why people are so stupid. But it's a way of being able to for ourselves to move beyond that and not be defined by something that has may perhaps been unskillful. And similarly to ourselves, learning how to offer forgiveness to ourselves, because sometimes we don't even understand ourselves. So it's an important way of allowing ourselves to move forward in a skillful way. Something that, like in the monastic communities, it's kind of formalized or ritualized, where one doing a ceremony. So it's like of taking formal leave. Part of the, say, taking formal leave of if a monk is going somewhere, he's going to be away for a while, he'll take leave. And the way of taking leave is asking for forgiveness. That's the formal way. It's formalized, but it's very meaningful in the sense that to take, say a junior monk will take leave from the senior monk, and he'll ask for forgiveness. But then the senior monk will say, "Yes, I offer forgiveness. May you also forgive me." It's ritualized or formalized, but behind it is a really important principle in the sense that the Buddha saying that we grow through our mutual support and mutual admonition. That's how we grow in the Dhamma. So that forgiveness is a big part of that. What do you recommend for pet owners with aging sick pets? Do they get to live out their lives, in this case a cat life, or is a merciful end at the hands of a vet okay? If you come to Abhayagiri, you'll notice we don't have pets. That's where you end up. Those are uncomfortable decisions. My own preference or my own inclination is to look after. We've taken on the pets to be our pets, so to look after them until they naturally die. That would be my bias or my preference. I can also recognize it that, but because sometimes it's painful to watch, to see, but that's those are uncomfortable decisions. Could you share some suggestions and advice for using the breath body as an object of meditation? This seems like a skillful way of meditating when the gross physical body is experiencing a lot of pain in the almost intolerable range. Is there any drawback to that? There is no drawback to that. We use the experience of the body And so I was mentioning, I guess this afternoon, or this morning rather, this fullness of the breath, bathing the body in the breath. There's a... as we allow that fullness to express itself or draw close to that as an experience, the kind of experience of the breath starts to stand out, and the actual physical body goes into abeyance. And it's so that, and also the as the paying attention to this quality of fullness and well-being, like you're bathing the body in the sensation of the breath, allowing the rhythm of the breath and the touch of the breath within the body. The body sort of starts to drop away, and the feeling of well-being and pleasure starts to stand up, and then that's more of a the breath body becomes more predominant, and a lot of it is because it's more comfortable it's helpful to recognize that we can experience that, because when we're using the body as a touch point for our object of the meditation, it isn't limited to, and as I'm anchoring it in the body or grounding it in the body, it allows us to have a solid base, so that the experience of the breath can then be a bit more, so the energetic of the breath has a good basis or foundation. I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but there is this natural inclination of the mind to be drawn to what is more comfortable and pleasant, so that as the mindfulness of the body becomes stronger, and the breath is there, then the actual experience of the rhythm or the tone of it will start to stand out, and that's where pleasure. And in the Buddha's instructions on mindfulness of breathing, on anapanasati, sort of experiencing piti, which is rapture or ease. I breathe in, experiencing piti. I breathe out, experiencing pleasure. I breathe in, experiencing pleasure. I breathe out. So that the breathing process is taking place. The mindfulness of breathing is there, but what is starting to become linked or inextricable is the actual experience of that well-being and pleasure. And so that becomes sort of like the experience of the breath is then associated with the pleasure. So that too, and that's a kind of like a breath body. Can you address dependent origination and causation? And I can, but I might not. It's a really big topic. But I think one of the things that's important is, dependent origination is can become quite refined, quite detailed. But what's important is to recognize that what's underpinning it is the causal process, or the Buddha calls idda paccayata, which is a very simple when this. And I can't remember exactly the exact idiom, but it's sort of, when this is, that is, when that arises, this comes to be. When this is not, that is not. When this ceases, that ceases. So that there's a rising and ceasing causal principle underlying dependent origination. And this is an essential foundation of the Buddhist teachings, in that the Buddha doesn't posit a spiritual or religious teaching on some kind of creator God or intervention by the celestial beings. He's coming back and pointing to these natural principles of when this cause is there, this result takes place. And in particular, in the process of how we can be free of suffering. It can get overly detailed, or we get too caught up in the details of it, but it's helpful to keep stepping back and looking at it. It's like Ajahn Chah giving the example he said it's like falling out of a tree. As you're falling down, you can count the branches as you're going down if you want, but all you really need to know is it going to hurt when it hits the bottom? so that similarly, you know that there's these certain processes are happening, but you know where it's going. So that understanding that fundamental principle of arising of dukkha, cessation of dukkha. That's the most important piece. Can you tell us your story when you decided to become a monk? Many people have heard it, but There's quite a few new people on the retreat as well. I was introduced to Buddhism just by taking a university course on Eastern studies, Eastern religions, and that got me interested in Buddhism. And I went to university in Winnipeg, which is it's nowhere. And in the late 1960s, trying to find information about Buddhism, I was, and I tracked down everything I could find. Still didn't know much about Buddhism, but so then after university, I headed off off on travels and traveled through Europe and Middle East and India, as was the route in those days, and then ended up in Thailand, mainly because it was on the way to Indonesia and Australia. I didn't know that Thailand was a Buddhist country, so that. And most of the books that I read were about Japanese Zen. So I had a vague idea in my mind, okay, when I'm going to travel and I'll end up in Japan and I'll study Buddhism there. But I've been traveling about a year at that point, and I was starting to get tired of traveling, and then I'm in a Buddhist country, and it's really, I just felt a very strong affinity to Thailand, Thai culture, and so then I wanted to learn how to meditate. Nothing really grabbed me in India, so that when I got to Thailand, then I realized it was a Buddhist country. Okay, I can find out how to meditate. And so my introduction to meditation, I was doing a 1 month long Mahasi Sayadaw retreat, where you do it on your own, in solitude, and you're expected to be meditating about 14 to 18 hours a day, which, that's how I started. So I didn't know any better, so I just did it. I had a great time. But then it's sort of, oh wow, this is, well, I want to learn more. And so I went and stayed at another monastery and practiced there, and then the monks saw me interested. The monastery that I was at was on the outskirts of Bangkok. It had a good English library as well as a meditation section, so studying and meditating. And some of the Thai monks that were there, they said, "Why don't you ordain?" And I said, "Oh, I can't ordain." I said, "I couldn't live my life like this." And because my assumption is from coming from a Western background, and is that if you ordain as a monk, then you have to ordain the rest of your life. You have to sort of lifetime vows. That didn't really attract me. And And then, but they said, oh, no. You know, in Thailand, it's ordinary to take temporary ordination. You know, so 3 months, 4 months. I said, 3 or 4 months, I could do that. So that was it. That was the hook. So that, I just stumbled in to being a monk. And here I am 42 years later. and had, you know, great good fortune to meet exceptional teachers. Ajahn Chah, very exceptional. Although he was... I ordained in Bangkok, and then my teacher encouraged me to go up, and I think I mentioned it this afternoon. Went up to visit Ajahn Chah's monastery just to see it, because I kept hearing about these forest monasteries, and was really touched by it and touched by Ajahn Chah's presence. But when I went into the monastery and then paid my respects to him on arrival, he just sort of looked at me for a bit. And if you want to stay here, you have to stay at least 5 years. That was my introduction to Ajahn Chah. It was the first thing he said to me. So I was ready to get out of there. I stayed for a while, but just the idea of 5 years was, you know, you're in your early 20s. I mean, 5 years is a lifetime. But I went off and stayed at another monastery. A newly established monastery, and it was very, it was quite quiet. I meditated diligently, had very good experiences in meditation, and get a better feel for the what it meant to be a monk, and I just kept thinking about Ajahn Chah. So I said, okay, 5 years is 5 years. I got to go back. Of course, then it gets the end of the 5 years, and it's five. Okay, I'm finished my 5 years. Feels like I got a decent start. So that's been the story of my life. Okay, keep exploring. This is sort of covered in a previous question, but it's a little nuance to it. So, is it important in this practice to ask for forgiveness for intentional/non-intentional actions, both in this life and in past lives? You know, as I was explaining about forgiveness as a practice, it's a what it's doing is setting up an intention of harmlessness and a humility and a sincere wish to live for the not creating suffering for oneself, not creating suffering for others, so that it's an affirmation of that intention, and so that's an important principle, rather than you've got to go through the list of all of the awful things that you did in this life and all your past lives. I mean, because we can get obsessed in that way. But it's more like, It's a practice that we can set up a really skillful inclination of mind and volition, where we're acting out of loving kindness and compassion for ourselves and for others, and that's a very fruitful intention to set. And so that, yeah, see, reflecting on the kind of the underlying dynamic of that, what one wants to that one wants to establish. Do you have any suggestions for the position of the hands during standing meditation? I think, you know, in terms of say, in standing meditation, main thing is that you're comfortable, so with the standing meditation. Then just experimenting and see, well, what feels comfortable. Because sometimes it's just letting them, say, hang loosely so that there's a certain ease there. Or bringing the hands together in a similar way that when we're sitting meditation, there's a certain sort of container or composure that's there in the posture. You know, so paying attention, because you see that the postures affect us. So oftentimes it might not be that overt or clear, but you realize, yeah, the way we hold our body has an effect, and to kind of tune into that, so that there's one that it's comfortable, it's not distracting to hold the say the position of the hands in something that's too straining or too strenuous, but there's a sense of a container that's there. Sometimes just clasping them in some way gives a kind of a tightness or composure container, and that's helpful when you're standing. Similarly, of course, when you're walking. You know, doing walking meditation, it's important that I'd like to clasp the hands. The way Ajahn Mun was adamant, you clasp the hands in front, you don't clasp the hands in back. I don't know why. There is a, say, rather than doing, say, when you're walking meditation, and your sort of hands sort of swinging around, and so there's a different feeling of composure just by keeping the hands clasped, and there's a container that's there. And with the standing meditation, I mean, that it's helpful to, it's important that what, you know, really whatever posture, that there's a certain comfort that's there, and ease. Although, say, like Ajahn Nyaniko's been leading in Qigong, and you do, I don't know if you're doing at the end, that period of standing where you're just standing like a tree. And so you're holding your arms up like that, relaxing into it. What is the energy that comes from that? So that it's paying attention to the effect that's there, because what one's wanting to do is get that balance of sort of energizing but relaxing. A certain composure, but a sense of ease. So those are some things to consider. So I think that's all the questions for today. We have a little bit of a break. Come back for puja.